As 2020 dawned, the worst pandemic in a century swept across the globe. It may take decades to fully understand its consequences, but from the very beginning, one thing was clear. Where most of us saw suffering, solidarity, and an immense loss of life, a tiny but powerful minority took the opportunity to enrich themselves and grab more power. My name is Sean Macheza, and you're listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a counter-history by the Transnational Institute. Over the course of 5 episodes, we're covering some of the major moments that have shaped the international left over the last 50 years. It's a story of ideas, movements, and personalities who have shaped the world today. It's a story of the rise of new forms of capitalism and authoritarianism. It's also the story of a global progressive think tank, the Transnational Institute, or TNI. And above all, it's a story of resistance and hope. Here's Arun Kunnani.
I did a series of interviews with 10 people, each of whom had crucial things to say about the different aspects of the kind of politics of that moment of the pandemic across a range of issues, from like corporate control of healthcare to the way that governments were bringing in emergency measures to suppress dissent or to increase the kind of clampdown on migrants and so on. So I did an interview with Seda Gurses, who is she describes herself as a critical computer scientist. She's based in Belgium. And she talked about how COVID provided an opportunity for the big tech corporation, Apple and Google and so on, to do something that gained them a presence in the whole question of healthcare that is completely different from in the past. We'd seen like privatization of healthcare is something that we're familiar with over the recent decades, right? Of healthcare services that are under public control of governments being privatized so that you now deal with a private company and perhaps you have a government paying for the costs, or maybe it's the consumers who have to pay for the costs. But in any case, that's a familiar picture of privatization. What Seda Gurses was bringing out was what happened with COVID was something actually on a more deeper level in terms of the corporate control and corporate capture of this space, right? What she's saying is that because Apple and Google controlled the infrastructure of our cell phones, which provided a way for those phones to do tracking, right? Because when the two phones come near to each other, that can be recorded. And so we can use that to track the spread of the virus. And they provided that service to healthcare authorities around the world for free, right? And they didn't, so they weren't saying we can provide this private healthcare service to you and you pay us for this service. They provide it for free. What did they get in return? What they got was the seat at the table of healthcare decision making for the future. So what that means is that actually whenever, you know, public policy decisions in the future are being made about how do governments deliver healthcare, right? Apple and Google now get that seat at the table, right? Because they've integrated themselves into the public policy making infrastructure. That's very different from how we thought about privatization in the past, right? And then another interview that I did that I thought was really crucial is with a health rights advocate in Britain called Moga Kamalyani. And she talked about, we got into the real detail of what it meant for these big pharmaceutical corporations to control the vaccine, essentially, but alongside other aspects of the infrastructure necessary to tackle the pandemic, right? So with the, and so the thing that I think just many people aren't aware of is it was public money that was paid to the big pharmaceutical corporations for them to do their research. And then we paid public money again for us to buy the vaccines as a result of that research, right? So we paid twice out of public money, generating super profits for these pharmaceutical corporations. And we don't even have transparency on how that public money was spent by these pharmaceutical corporations. Like, they claim that all that money that was paid to them for the research went into that research, and that research is so costly and expensive and so on. But we have no real counting of that. What the percentage of that went into profits for that company, we don't know. It could be very much larger than what most than the normal rate of profit for corporations, right? And then, of course, the fact that these vaccines were controlled by private corporations in the distribution as well meant that we had internationally this vaccine apartheid where, you know, people who hadn't had the vaccine for the first time and where it would have been life-saving weren't getting it in certain parts of the world, in the global south in particular, but then in the richer parts of the world, people were, at the same time, were getting free for vaccines, which is great. But like, actually, at that point, it's no longer, if your aim is just to prevent loss of human life, you would be distributing that vaccine in a very different way. And we don't know how many lives that were lost unnecessarily, like after we had the vaccine, and we could have prevented a lot more loss of life. Probably it's on a scale of millions, right? Given the total death toll. And that, there's never been any accounting for that. That's like millions of people's lives lost simply for corporate profit making, right? And it's not, and corporate profit making generated essentially out of public resources, right? It's just an outrage that this has never been, you know, never been an issue that we've been able to, because this is going to happen again. You know, we're going to have pandemics again. And unless we do something to reorganize how we fund and distribute things like vaccines, we're gonna have the same kind of totally unnecessary human devastation.
The 2020s to date has been a series of extreme crises, even as many of the horrors of earlier decades showed no signs of abating. But even faced with new challenges, too often, policymakers were rehashing the same unjust failed strategies, including the age-old strategy of building walls.
Looking at the role of the European Union in militarizing borders, rolling out militarized policies across the board, so regardless of what the problem is, the solution is a militarized one. We've seen that with climate change, climate breakdown, being approached from a militaristic angle, even though war is one of the biggest contributors to climate breakdown. The same with borders, people who are migrating, coming up against militarized border structures. The same with COVID-19. We saw that the response to COVID-19 was very much rolling out heavy-handed policing. I suppose it all goes to the same thing that, like, regardless of the problem, the solution is a militarized one. So I suppose the work that we were doing then and continue to do looks very much at the way the policies have been taking shape in the European Union and then how they play out in countries far beyond Europe. So often the policies will be drawn up in Brussels, but actually they will be about rolling out border externalization policies.
I think, unfortunately, we'd have to say that the international left, however you want to define that, has failed really to stop this kind of relentless expansion of border infrastructure around the world with all the kind of resulting violence that causes, right? Border infrastructure has increased steadily throughout the neoliberal era since the 1970s, and we haven't been able to break that trajectory. And I think there's a direct relationship between a kind of neoliberal order, a neoliberal political economic system, that kind of form of capitalism, and the need for borders, right? Borders enable the management of workforces through racial and ethnic and religious differentiation, which I think is part of how this system works, right? So if you look in the United States, you can go to El Paso in Texas, which is a city on the border with Mexico, right? And the border between the United States and Mexico basically runs through a single conurbation. On the American side, it's called El Paso. On the Mexican side, it's called Juarez. But it's basically the same conurbation, artificially divided by a border. Now, on the U.S. side of the border, workers are paid about 10 times what they're paid on the Mexican side of the border for the same work. So what does that border do? It enables corporations to be able to move across that border to Mexico and find cheap workforces who are effectively trapped by that border from accessing the wages that would correspond to the market in which what they're making, where it's sold, right? And so borders generate profits for corporations. They also do that by enabling undocumented workforces to exist within the richer countries that can be exploited even more, because they are effectively racially segregated from the rest of the working classes in that country as migrants, and subject therefore also to much more intense forms of repression by the state, which prevents them being able to get their rights as workers as well. So, you know, I think that's why, you know, it's because it's structural to this particular form of capitalism that we've had for the last few decades, that you get this relentless expansion in the border infrastructure, right? And the politics of borders reflects that. If you look at Britain, where we had a general election recently, obviously, and both parties are advocating for the expansion of border powers, right? Like and this has been the general pattern right through since the 1970s. The Conservative Party with their slogan of stop the boats, but also the Labour Party. Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, is talking about how there are too many people coming from Bangladesh and he's going to make sure you get the planes going to take people back to where they came from, right? And then, of course, it's no surprise then that over the last week, that kind of political climate has fueled the far right, who've had this massive mobilization over the last week in England, where you're seeing them go after attacking mosques, attacking hotels where refugee families are being accommodated. And for the first time in Britain, actually being outnumbered in particular, being outnumbering anti-fascists and our people and anti-racists, right, in particular places, and outnumbering even the police, so that they actually are breaking into those hotels, right, and families are being intimidated and running in fear, right? This has never happened before in Britain, right? This is in the past, we would have always had more numbers and we would have been able to defend communities on the streets. But unfortunately, we've become very disorganized and Muslim communities who are on the receiving end of a lot of this in Britain have been, a lot of the kind of mobilization that used to exist in those communities has been depoliticized and disorganized through various forms of government repression over the last decade or so, right? So I'm afraid it's a pretty depressing picture, but we have to get our heads around why this expansion of border infrastructure continues relentlessly and how it relates to the economic system that we have. And only then, I think, can we begin to think about how we oppose it effectively.
So the European Union basically calling the shots on how Niger or Senegal or Azerbaijan, countries far beyond Europe's shores, are implementing their border policies. And that there's multilateral and bilateral agreements in place where the European Union will apply a carrot and stick approach. So we'll give you this amount of money to do this thing if you implement this border policy to stop people moving in the direction of Europe, for example. Yeah, so there's a lot of the work on the border stuff. Obviously, then it goes hand in hand with the European Union developing its defence. And I'm putting that in inverted commas, its defence industry and defense sector. It's really got very little, if anything, to do with defense. It's more about pushing forward a war economy. The agency that's often rolling out these border policies is Frontex, so the European Union's border and coast guard agency. Frontex has a mandate to deploy a standing guard, which would be armed and have an autonomous mandate, which would operate separate to any of its member states. That hasn't happened yet, but it's also separately, Europe has these European battle groups, which are also deployed, can be deployed and mandated separate to any member state, but would be working from a European Union mandate. So I suppose in focusing in on Frontex, it is the embodiment of all of what the European Union's militarized policies, they can all be centered on how Frontex is structured. The question, what is the European Union? What direction is it going in? What sovereignty do states within the European Union have? Have they handed over a lot of that to the European Union? Are there questions there for the people of Europe, and to what extent they have an influence over what's happening in Brussels, or has that decision-making been taken from the people and placed into the hands of people in lobbying groups who are lobbying for the arms industry, for example?
But even with this bleak state of affairs, movements have continued to organize and innovate around the world. Katie Sandwell is a program coordinator at TNI. She works across a range of issues related to climate, environmental and agrarian justice, public alternatives, energy democracy, land and territories, fair trade medicinal plants, agroecology, and food sovereignty.
An important part of our work is still with rural and agrarian movements, but we also work very closely with labor movements, and especially with labor movements in the global south. And we've had the opportunity to really work in our research, but also in some of our more organizing and kind of political process work, and in our work with activist scholars, on how we can help to bring together or to find common ground or common concerns between those two traditionally quite separate and quite different groups of actors. So rural and agrarian working people on the one hand, whether that's small-scale fishers, pastoralists, or self-identified peasant farmers, whether or also indigenous and local communities living off the land, but on the one hand, and then on the other hand, more urban-based workforces in a variety of different industries, both formal and informal. And the work that we've been doing in that domain has been organized under the kind of framework of a just transition. So the concept of just transition really originates out of labor movements in North America in the more or less in the 70s. But it's since then evolved to become a kind of a global conversation about what a transition to a more sustainable economy should look like. And if it's to be done in a fair and just way for working people, what should it look like? At the same time, that concept is also facing co-optation from corporate actors or just from people who have a much kind of narrower vision of it. So I'll say that T&I and the movements we work with are not engaging in a neutral way with this, with the concept of just transition. We really see our work as fighting for a specific vision of just transition, right? For an idea of what justice means in that. And I would say our work on bringing together both rural and urban working people is part of that and is something that's fairly distinctive to the vision of T&I and our allies in this space, that it's not just focused on workers in a particular sector, which you sometimes see in just transition proposals. They focus very much on, for example, workers in the energy sector, who are obviously critical, but we think that a just transition actually needs to embrace a whole social change. Working with movements, we had a series of discussions about how we see a just transition, that sort of more radical and transformative vision of just transition. Mm-hmm. And a couple of the key kind of factors that we identified there that I think are important to understand what we mean about it is, in the first place, that it's about wider social transformation. So it's not about replacing one energy source with another, but it gets deeper into these questions of energy for what and for whom. It's centered on the needs of working people in all of their diversity, rural and urban, but also diversity around the geography, different sectors, and all different kinds of workers. Mm-hmm. See it also as an explicitly anti-racist and feminist, indeed intersectional feminist as well, perspective on the kind of change we need to go through, so that it needs to actively embed measures to address the racist history of capitalism and of the fossil fuel system that we're dealing with, from environmental injustice to the kind of current challenges of climate change, which are being imposed on parts of the world that have contributed least to present climate change. At the same time, we see it as being not just about carbon emissions. That's certainly a part of what is going on and needs to change in the transition. But there's also this much broader discourse of environmental justice. So we need to look also at other kinds of environmental damage and of environmental justice that play out at different scales. We see just transition as really being about democratization, so putting control of our energy systems, but even more broadly than that, of our economy, back in the hands of working people through democratic mechanisms and through a shift towards energy democracy and towards more public energy futures. I think very fundamentally, we really think that the vision of just transition is going to mean different things in different places. So if we talk about, for example, the different impacts of climate change in different places, but also the different historically differentiated impacts, let's say, of colonialism, of imperialism, that means that the kinds of changes and transformations that take place need to be grounded in the politics and of the demands and of the needs of people in different regions.
People have been organizing on new and emerging frontiers as well.
So the ocean spaces, ocean and coastal spaces of the world, we really see are being targeted as a kind of a new frontier for capitalist expansion. And that's playing out in a lot of different ways, from deep sea mining to huge expansions in shipping, to ramping up of aquaculture for more capital intensive food production in ocean spaces. And all of those dynamics are leading to the huge displacement, and in many places really almost disappearance, of traditional small-scale fishers. But it's not just a bad news story, because I bring this as a case of inspiration. Those fishers have also been really actively mobilizing and organizing to defend their own rights. And they have been coming together in a process. Increasingly, they're identifying themselves as the ocean peoples of the world. And they've held a series of tribunals, which are called, some have been called the tribunals, the Blue Economy Tribunals, and some the Ocean People Tribunals. But first in around the Indian Ocean, in six different locations around the Indian Ocean, then in Brazil, and now most recently in South Africa. And these fishers have come together in these very large, very well organized tribunals to really document and make a judgment on the situation that they're confronting, and to denounce the kind of human rights abuses, the violations going on against the various instruments like the small scale fisheries guidelines, but also the UN Declaration on the Rights of Peasants and other people working in rural areas, all of which offer an international human rights protection to fishers, but are really not being respected or not being implemented. So these tribunal processes have allowed hundreds, and I think in some cases even thousands, of people to really come together and articulate what are the challenges they are facing, what are the dispossessions and the abuses that they're facing, and what is the alternative that they see before them, what is their vision of a just future, and of a just future for small-scale fisher people, but also for our ocean ecosystems and for the ocean territories that they have been protecting and living in for centuries.
Challenges to a just transition abound, arguably most visibly from some of the people who claim to be advancing it. The race for renewals has created new exploitation up and down supply chains and seen geopolitical maneuvering that once again has foisted unjust conditions on the working peoples of the global south.
The Energy Charter Treaty is a multilateral investment agreement specifically in the area of energy that was designed around the 90s in a very specific context where former Soviet countries were getting integrated, and the EU wanted to make sure that there would be free flow of energy transit among the Well, especially towards the European Union, and also in the context of the fossil fuel area. So we know that during the negotiations of the Energy Charter Treaty, which is ECT to call it shorter, we know that during the negotiations, companies like Shell, BP, Exxon were very much engaged into specifically writing down what the text should say. And they were very much also in favor of expanding the investors' rights in many different forms. But one of those forms in particular was including investment state dispute settlement as one of the ways to solve any type of dispute that could arise between an investor and any of the signatory countries. And we can say that it was a treaty that was pretty silent in the first 20 years of its existence. But then we started to see some very specific ISDS cases that were started to hit against European countries. So I like to call this that it was some kind of boomerang effect, because what the EU sponsored and really pushed to happen, in thinking that it would only happen to former Soviet countries, it actually started to become a reality and to have effect inside the European Union. And so TNI very visionary in that sense. Together with CEO Corporate Europe Observatory, we started to research a bit more into what this treaty is about. And the more we researched, the more we found information that was in very, it was very bad, basically, what the content of the treaty was and what the extent it can have in terms of impact. Again, this was a treaty that was specifically about energy. It became clear again that this was going to be another big campaign that we could have together with other European organizations, so in a coalition, in coordination, and that we could win. So in 2018, we wrote this report, and from that day until basically this year, 2024, and we are still working on the ECT, we've had many different, firstly, after the report, again, we had conversations and we had calls with the European Trade Justice Coalition to see how we could work together on this. And one of the first learnings that we had was that this was not a treaty that we could only work from the trade angle, but we definitely needed to engage more on the climate side of what this treaty meant. Because again, it was a treaty very much sponsored by the fossil fuel industry. And it was very much used by the fossil fuel industry as an instrument to keep their privileges in the countries that they were investing. So it was very clear that the angle not only had to do about trade, but it had to do about climate and energy. And also we started to talk to organizations that were not our usual partners when we would work around trade. So we would go to talk with, for example, Can Europe, which is the climate action network. And we would ask them and try to see if they would be interested potentially in joining this campaign. And they were very positive since the beginning that this was a huge deal and they had to be engaged. Of course, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth, so big environmental organizations. But then not only that, because we also started to engage with climate activists like Extinction Rebellion, Fridays for Future. And then different movements around Europe started to be interested in what the ECT was about, the Energy Charter Treaty. So again, we could never win, or we could never work around trade agreements if we would not be able to. So after many years of work, we can say that we did manage on the narrative side to set the narrative firmly that the ECT is a climate wrecking treaty. And there is no doubt that anybody can relate the ECT to something else. Because starting in 2022, we had a number of countries that started to speak out against being part of the Energy Charter Treaty. And these are countries that traditionally would defend this type of investment protection agreements, but they saw clearly how the Energy Charter Treaty was something that was backfiring then, and it was going against some of their more innovative legislation around climate. So it was just simply not, there was no benefit of being part of the Energy Charter Treaty anymore. But what is interesting is that the countries that would leave the Energy Charter Treaty starting in 2022, they would leave the Energy Charter Treaty with an environmental argument. This was not common until now to hear politicians talk this way about investment treaties, because let's be fair, in general, there is a majority that defends this type of agreement. So part of the success was that we got, starting in 2022, around 10 European Union countries that left the Energy Charter Treaty, including Spain, France, Germany, Poland, and also the UK. And then last year, the European Union agreed in the council that the European Union as a whole would also leave the Energy Charter Treaty. So we can basically say that this is a dead treaty because half of its founding members are not part of the treaty anymore. So what the challenge is now is how can we use this momentum to get rid of more than 3,000 investment agreements that exist across the world that also protect fossil fuel corporations. So we are actually currently now in 2024 working towards a bigger campaign where we can end fossil fuel protection in the form of investment agreements. So just to say that this is a never-ending story. One success takes us to the next story that we will engage into.
The situation in the Arab region, where renewable energy projects are booming, but the benefits are reaped by a privileged minority and corporations that are complicit and also responsible for the climate crisis we are experiencing. Take, for example, the case of Morocco, which has lots of green potential and is developing large-scale plans to produce green hydrogen. In recent years, Morocco signed several agreements with foreign companies to export up to 70% of the green hydrogen it produces. Meanwhile, the country's primary energy mix remains dominated by fossil fuels, which account for 92% of the mix, while renewable energies account for only 20% in electricity generation. The planned huge renewable energy projects for exports such as Xlinx, Tunur, and Desert Deck would also occupy the land traditionally used by local communities for pastoralism and use up already scarce resources like water. And the companies behind the projects are often the same fossil fuel giants responsible for the climate crisis.
That was Hamza Hamushin, coordinator of the North Africa work at the Transnational Institute. Together with Katie Sandwell, Hamza recently co-edited a book called Dismantling Green Colonialism.
We're seeing that a lot of the existing dynamics of repression, of environmental injustice, of racialized environmental injustice, a lot of those are being perpetuated rather than transformed. And in some cases, they are even being intensified with the quest for new kinds of quote unquote green resources, whether that's about land for solar and wind installations being taken from local communities, or whether that's about the extraction, for example, of so-called critical raw materials, which are being used in the production of those things. We see these same kinds of dynamics that new sacrifice zones are being created in order to allow for the continuation of a high level of consumption in some parts of the world and by some people in some parts of the world, more accurately. And this book focused in on the situation in the Middle East and North Africa. The book is authored almost entirely by people from the region. We're working in different relations, working on the region and based in different countries within the region. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a deliberate political choice, because part of the situation that the book is responding to is the fact that a lot of the discourse about green energy or green transition in globally, to be honest, but especially in the Middle East and North Africa, is really dominated by these kind of neoliberal institutions, right? Whether at the state level, some academic institutions, but also the international financial institutions, for example, and a certain amount of major international funders, all have this kind of shared discourse of what a green transition should look like, that it needs to be capital-led, capital-intensive, very technology-intensive, and geared at preserving a certain kind of consumption among a certain class of people. So this book really sought to bring different voices out, bring different voices to the table who are being usually marginalized in those conversations, right? So people working locally and working at the grassroots level people from the region and people with a much stronger political analysis of what's going on there, as well as with their own really strong proposals about what a transition should look like or could look like instead.
Beyond COVID, the return of Trump, the ongoing rise of the far right, the climate, and Russia's bloody war in Ukraine, the 2020s so far had more shocks in store. An issue that has preoccupied TNI from its very beginnings, a terrible injustice that the world seemed content to ignore, was brought violently back to international attention in 2023. Palestine. Here's Arun Kundnani. Here he refers to TNI's first director, Iqbal Ahmed, who we discussed in episode one.
Iqbal Ahmed was a kind of key figure, really, in the Palestinian liberation movement until he died in the late 1990s. Although he was not Palestinian, he was Pakistani. But in the 1960s, he became involved with the anti-colonial movement in Algeria and worked closely with Frantz Fanon. And then in the end of the 1960s, when he was settled in the United States, he worked with the Arab diaspora in the United States that was working on the Palestine issue and became close to them, especially Edward Said, who became a close friend. And I think Iqbal gives us, I think he's probably one of the most important and insightful analysts of imperialism and anti-imperialism over the last 50 years. He builds on the earlier work that had already been done by Palestinians, Fayez Saeed, with his book, Zionist Colonialism in Palestine, which comes out in 1965. He builds on that work, and that work is arguing that Zionism is a form of colonialism and racism. And Saeed is seeing that in terms of comparing that to European colonialism across Africa and Asia and so on. But Iqbal Ahmed, then, when he really starts to write about the colonialism in the 1980s, he's agreeing with all of that, but then developing it further in this really important way, which is to focus very much more on the settler part of the colonialism, like what does settler culture look like, and comparing Zionism much more to European colonialism in the Americas, right, which of course is where the settler concept is much more relevant than much other European colonialism. I think that brings out a whole load of insights which now have been taken up by academia in a much more extensive way in the last few years, but he's doing this stuff in the 1980s. And then the other part of it is the question of violence in colonialism and anti-colonialism. I think he was involved very directly in conversations in the Palestinian movement about that. And his kind of argument is that in the end, the struggle, it may well involve some kind of armed struggle. He's not a pacifist, but he's saying that in the end, what matters above all else is the ability to win at the political level, right? And so the armed struggle is going to be in service to that. And so the aim is ultimately to achieve what he calls the moral isolation of the adversary. In other words, you want Zionism to be seen as morally bankrupt, not only by Palestinians and people in the global south, but also by its own core constituencies, such as the general public in the United States and so on. And I think in many ways, what we've seen in terms of the pro-Palestinian movement and how it's flowered, really, in the last 10 months, I think in many ways reflects those insights and that kind of strategic thing.
Speaking at TNI's key 50th anniversary event, the Ignite Festival, Abir Kopti described why Palestine and the international mobilization around it are so key to the whole world.
There are a few governments who are willing to support their colonial project at any cost. And for me, I think this is the most important revelation here, at any cost. At one time, I thought that if they realized that the cost of supporting Israel is more than the loss of supporting Israel, something will change in the mindset. But apparently, no. Apparently, they are willing to pay the cost, and it's really costing to protect their colonial project. And the cost is not just in lives. It is really tragic that the cost is really high in lives, but apparently some lives are less worthy, and we know that, and we talked about it a lot. But the cost is also that the arms of oppression and is extending into Europe. it's extending into those Western countries. It is not just the oppression, it's the willing of twisting every law, every rule to support Israel. It's the unleashing of the racism and anti-immigrant, anti-Palestinian, anti-Arab, anti-African discourse. It's the willing to crush your freedom of speech in order to protect Israel. It's the will to give up all the values people have been lecturing to the world. It is also the will to expose completely and remove the facade of values and human rights and democracy and freedom of speech. Those regimes are willing to remove this facade and be exposed in full daylight in order to protect a colonial project that is called Israel. People here need to understand that there is a price of supporting genocide, of supporting aggression, of continuous supporting. And it's not going to stop in Palestine or the Middle East or in Africa. And we're talking here about just few countries versus the rest of the world. Sometimes we're so angry and we say the world is dark, the world is bad, the world is like this and that. I say it all the time. Actually, it's not the world. The world is fine. There are millions and millions of people. There are numerous hundreds, thousands of movements and institutions who are saying no. And this is the world. This is the world we want to build together. The few powers that are supporting the colonial project at any cost are not the world.
What Abir notes here is also a running thread in left-wing movements and the Transnational Institute's history. The few powers that are supporting the colonial project at any cost are not the world. And perhaps there we see a map to a better future through international solidarity and collective action.
I think it's enormously important because, of course, the opponents within the system, both states and corporations, have those kinds of relationships, right? They work very closely together and support each other. So indeed, we need to do the same. I think it would be, although it's by no means a straightforward victory, I think it's also really important to remember the international mobilization of solidarity with Palestine right now and against the occupation. So that has been obviously initiated by a terrible and tragic situation. And there have been very strong elements of repression of movements in support of Palestine. But we've nonetheless seen this, I think, quite amazing recognition that, colonization and occupation in one place cannot be ignored, right? That until all of us are free, none of us are free. And that's really, I think, coming to be understood at a much deeper level in movements than maybe in the 10 years that preceded it. And we're seeing huge new uprising of solidarity in support of people living under occupation, which I think is enormously important.
The whole organizing around Gaza has created an open space in the minds of, let's call it, Gen Z. We should fill that space beyond just the issue of Palestine, beyond just the issue of Israel, to use that space in order to be able to popularize the critique of capitalism, popularize the analysis of the rise of fascism around the alternatives to the current global capitalist system. I think it would be very important for the new generations, younger people, really, to take the lead on this at this point. Our generation lost. We were not able to shape the future. In fact, we got, after all the hopes of the 60s and the 70s, the whole dream of a socialist future was beaten back. It's very important for the younger people to really go beyond the thinking of our generation. And I'm speaking about the boomer generation. Right. Because there's still a tendency either to assert the directions of our thinking or for younger people to still look onto our paradigms.
Marcus Ruskin, a co-founder of TNI, said, "When a situation seems hopeless, then you are the hope. When everything looks dark, you must be the light. We asked our guests where in these strange times they see light. Where do they see hope for the future?
A very good question, and I think an important one to recognize the victories that help us to know that we're heading in the right direction.
It's
very non-accidental that I work across so many kind of different areas, and it really comes from TNI's analysis that these different kinds of transformation are really connected to each other, that we can't transform one area of the economy independent of the rest, right? It's not a sectoral thing. Even if we're working with fishers or with miners, they're part of this bigger system in need of transformation. What I have found really powerful and really inspiring is to see more and more cases where movements from quite different backgrounds, whether different regions or different sectors or different core political concerns or demands, are coming together in new kinds of coalitions and are working together both to identify common problems, to stand in solidarity with each other, but most excitingly, to really work and build towards common solutions and proposals for transformation. So I think there have been numerous important examples of that in the last years. One in which TNI was quite active was a conference which took place in Chile, I think in 2022, if I'm right, which was called Our Future is Public, and which brought together a really wide range of actors working on all different aspects of public services and public futures. So looking at energy democracy, but looking also at community control of water and really developing shared goals and principles, including an international energy democracy declaration, but also a process to work on a global push towards public services. I think another important one has been the convergence in 2024. There was a major event in Morocco, which brought together actors working on the question of unjust and odious debt and economic justice, together with actors working on climate change. So really pushing for a kind of common agenda that sees the challenges of the climate crisis and the questions of how people in the global south are going to be able to respond to the climate crisis, seeing that as really fundamentally linked to the question of global economic injustice and the continued imperialist extraction of resources, of money, of people from the global south, and saying that we need to tackle those kinds of problems together. The other one that I am most involved with is the process of global food sovereignty movements towards a gathering which will take place next year in 2025 in South Asia, which is called going under the name of the Nyaleni Global Gathering. That's a historical reference to a community in Mali where the first such gathering took place. But this will uniquely be a gathering initiated by food sovereignty movements, but with really active participation and co-construction by climate movements, by international health movements, by labor movements. I see more and more of these processes of convergence, and that's something that really gives me hope for the future, for the kind of the birth of a new or at least continued kind of internationalist organizing that also recognizes the common challenges and the common elements of the system that we are confronting. I also think that internationalism has never been more critical, right? We have never had a greater need for people, for working people and for social movements from their local bases to organize in an internationalist way and in solidarity with their comrades in other countries and other regions. And I think that's something that from the founding of TNI 50 years ago has always been a kind of a core conviction, right? That we cannot look only to the global north or to the metropole or to the established centers of power to find the solutions to the crises we're facing. These really are solutions that will come from people whose voices have been marginalized historically, from people who have been excluded from conversations about what the future ought to look like. And those are the voices that we need to urgently bring in, right? If we're going to find a whole new way of doing things, then we need to also look to people who have not been heard historically. And I think that's a fundamental principle as well for how we move forward. I think another really interesting and important, I mentioned the Future is Public conference, but I think a really important kind of consequence of that area of work has been to really deepen our thinking in TNI and with our allies about what we mean by public and really digging in to what is the distance and what is the difference between the public, the communal, the collective, the common, on the one hand, versus the state on the other. And where do we see elements of the transition that really need a state or something like a state to organize them? Where do we see things that are very amenable to more kind of grassroots and bottom-up forms of organization? And how can we envision those two ways of working coming together and acting together in useful ways?
And we asked our guests for their predictions and their hopes for the future.
It feels that something has shifted quite deeply. I think the one is around the global order, including the international legal order. International law seems to have little meaning right now. Palestine, I think, has been an issue forever, but the genocide that we've seen unfolding there and the impunity with which that has happened has fomented global solidarity like we haven't seen since anti-apartheid. And I think it's forged a whole new generation that are not only defending Palestine, but are also furious with the hypocrisy of the West, the extent to which Israel's been allowed to get away with what it's done, the hypocrisy with respect to how international law is upheld or not. So I think something's really changed that has been epitomized in a way by what's happened in Palestine. But I think it's also around climate. We're all For decades now, there have been all these international agreements about how to move away from fossil fuels and how to at least mitigate, stop climate change getting worse, but also mitigate the worst effects. But very little has actually been achieved through all these climate summits. And then I think we have the far right agenda, and that's been a long time in the making, but I think the levels of misinformation, deliberate sowing of chaos, and then increasingly totalitarian trends from heavy repression to closing spaces for dissent, criminalizing political dissent, to what is looking like a real attempt to defund any activism. The role of private aid, of the kind of incorporation of movements into NGOs and so forth. We're now at that period where we're going to be closed down, basically, either through defunding or through criminalization. Makes for a very difficult moment in history. And that's accompanied by the rise of big tech. We've seen digitization go from nothing to where we are now. So it's been a very fast evolution. It's a monopoly of information. It's very easy through that monopoly position, as we've seen with Twitter or X, how easy it is to manipulate information and to manufacture hegemony, in a sense. I think that Western hegemony is in its dying days. I think the fossil fueled capitalism is also in its dying days. And there's very intense competition as to who controls the green economy that is necessary, but how you do it so that both those who control the energy sources now also control the energy sources of the future. So a very intense geopolitical competition. And then I think also this kind of north-south, I think that so-called developing states are no longer going to accept the status they have. I think in many of them where they have resources that are required for the new green economy gives them new power. You also have China is a serious player on the world stage. very much wanting to globalize, needing to globalize purely economically, but is also using that as a kind of soft power in a way to build its own hegemony and to serve as a kind of counterbalance in between the West and the rest. So yeah, so you know, whatever way you look at it, the world has entered new terrain and a very intense competition over the future. I think hope can be drawn from the victories of the past. We don't know our history enough anymore. So I think we need to go back and look at the victories of the past and learn from how those victories were achieved for strategies for the future. I think we don't invest enough in, there's anti-intellectualism that I feel is quite tangible in the last 10 or 15, 20 years. I think that thinking is really important. I think action alone is insufficient. We need to think and then act, and we need to think ahead so that we can act strategically. So I think we need to invest a lot more in philosophical thinkers, philosophical theory that bind us. My sense is your kind of postmodern theory, I think, has been very destructive politically and intellectually. It's deconstructed a whole lot. It's done away with the idea of truth, of fact, and it has not helped us to construct another way of looking at things, another way of being, another way of organizing.
Our enemies are strong. Our enemies are states. Our enemies are ruling classes. So how do we fight? Fight at certain levels. One fight is, our enemies don't just want to be able to do what they want to do and to carry on doing that. They also want to be accepted for what they do. We operate in terms of wanting to actually have big demonstrations, be a contribution to big struggles, which make it difficult for them to do what they want to do in terms of policies and try to change policies in that respect, or shirk policies and so on. The other area where we tend to be more successful, although we have successes even at that level, is delegitimizing, not letting them get away with making their support and propaganda. We are faced with, and this aspect of attacking them, criticizing them, exposing their thing is important, not only for delegitimizing, but for also extending popular morale and resistance for people. Because one of the interesting things is that we have countries that in states that are so much more powerful militarily and economically and so on, and yet they are not able, or they have to get out of countries that are much weaker when they try to invade them and so on, and they have to do that here. Don't underestimate the dimension of critique, and maybe at various levels in terms of attacking various policies that are doing their opposing their opposition here. Phyllis Bennis's work with regard to Israel. Today, for the first time, we are seeing something that did not exist before. The delegitimization of Zionism. This is something that has now come about. What is political conflict about? Political conflict is not above all a contest of arms. It is not above all a contest of economic strength. It is a contest of wills in which one side seeks to impose its will on the other side. And its economic strength and its military might are the means by which it seeks to do it. But what happens when the much weaker side, militarily or economically, nevertheless has a will to resist that is so wide and deep that it will not give up? And when that happens, you have Vietnam's victory. At great cost. You have all kinds of victories, the whole question of national liberation movements. You have Russians moving out of Afghanistan. And what it means is that progressive politics is about strengthening that will to resist. It's about deepening that will to resist. It's about expanding that will to resist. It's about creating that will to resist. And we do it, progressive politics does this in so many ways. We do it through our articles, our speeches, our demonstrations, our struggles, our cultural activities, all of these things are there.
There is always a way to work wherever we are, be it in the academy, be it continued work in the NGO, in social movements, or even if being elected in government, there is always a way how you can work for the better, how you can work for a more positive transformation in society. And it is important also to look at the history of struggles, because we are very lucky at the moment. I always say that, because all my life I've worked with people that were there before I started working. When I started my youth activism, I have seen the work, sweat, blood, and tears poured by older activists. Our generation actually benefited from that work. And the current generation also benefited from those layers and layers of struggles of the past generation.
I actually take great heart at the moment from the organizing around Palestine. I think that the Palestine movement is an anti-war movement. It's an anti-colonialism movement. And it's growing constantly. It's not going anywhere. It's growing constantly. Nobody is free until Palestine is free. And we have to, continue moving in the direction of anti-war, anti-colonialism, and, towards a world that is not dominated by US imperialism, where might is, but towards a world where there's space for everybody. And it's not about dominance and control and imperialism and war, but actually about peace.
The one thing we know about activism is that it's always very context dependent, right? And so I context change. So whatever my kind of lessons are that I can think of here and now, it's not going to be much use necessarily for someone somewhere else at a different time. But what I would say, just with that kind of, with all that modesty laid out in advance, I think the challenge that we have at the moment for left-wing activism in general is that we are dealing with a situation where neoliberalism has been so powerful that we all live within it, not just as an external force that impinges on us, but it's shaped our own thinking for each of us, right? And when we try and build a movement outwards, we confront the problem that every new person that we bring in is also shaped by this very thing that we're fighting, this kind of market competitiveness idea of how society is organized nowadays, right? And so as well as figuring out our external structures that we're trying to change, we also have to figure out how we change ourselves, right? And that makes it very hard. And then in our groups, in our move, in our activist circles, we then always have this tendency to also be competitive with each other, right? Or to think in terms of, we all carry with us our pain, right, of what has been done to us by this system. And neoliberalism encourages us to think of us each as having a unique kind of pain that's different from everyone else's pain, and that who I am is actually about me figuring out that pain and expressing it, right? Like that idea of individual self-expression as the solution to social problems, right, is such a core idea that we've been socialized into, that is actually also a destructive idea for building collective struggle, right? Because actually when we join with others in struggle, that generates a kind of joy, a kind of feeling of freedom, joy. There's something powerful about those feelings that actually helps us more than a kind of inwardness, a kind of constant turning inwardness to ourselves. And that's why that's what sometimes we find for the first time when we join movements, is a kind of love for others that we've never experienced. And so the principle there is, if you're searching for identity, who you are is not some truth inside yourself. Who you are is actually what you do with others, right? And that seems like a crucial thing that I think is necessary for us to bring when we're thinking about how do we bring people who've been socialized into these kind of competitive neoliberal individuals.
I think that history, as I said, is the history of bridges. But I will say it's also the history of solidarity. And if you ask me what I want to keep is solidarity for 50 more years. And I hope solidarity can be transformed into concrete things to keep improving people's lives.
to walk towards justice and real democracy. But without solidarity from the working class to the working class worldwide, we cannot keep walking. And D&I has been that bridge to be this, to link the solidarity hands from different regions, areas, political perspectives and trends, and to be able to express that and make that happen in concrete ways. Through ideas, but not only through ideas. To bring the ideas into movement, into the movement. I think that's the expression of solidarity. And that's what we need to keep as humanity.
You are not alone. And transformative change is possible. I remember when I started to become involved in this resistance to the financial sector, that a huge realization was that suddenly I was not alone. I think especially for those of us who have grown up with internet access, you are just very aware of everything that is going wrong in the world. So you have this huge pressure on your shoulders to do something or to block yourself so you don't know and you try to live with your life. I think definitely this creates immobility to some extent because there are just too many things going on or things that seem too powerful to even address. But systemic change has happened in the past. We have kings with divine right. We had institutionalized slavery. And 200 years ago, those structures and institutions seemed also impossible to break. And we did. So it's absolutely possible to change things. And you are not alone if you think that it's important to change them. And that's a very important step to the next step, which is seek collective action. It's the only way to achieve systemic transformative change. Of course, it's important when possible to change part of our lifestyle to make it more sustainable or more in line with our values. Collective action is fundamental. Just pick at an issue that matters to you. It might be animal rights, it can be women's rights, it can be the environment. There are always topics that affect you directly. So just take a bit of time on the internet to look who is actually doing something already. There's always people organized. Often there are people organized in your own city. So just take a few hours and go. Of course, this sounds easier to say in the Netherlands than in many other countries, as we know. So I'm talking from a very privileged position here. But yeah, it can just be a conversation around with your neighbors. There are always things that is possible to do. When you actually start moving, you realize the enormous power we have. It's really amazing. It really, there is this click where nothing is possible when suddenly everything is possible. The whole world is in front of you and you just need to decide where to go.
We have to build power. We have to change public consciousness and keep, never surrender to despair. We have so many examples of movement changing lots of things for the better, and learn from those, be inspired by them, and keep up the good work. But T and I, so you shouldn't sit there and rest on your laurels. You got 50 good years, but yeah, more good years. And there's a way of organizing work and conversations that lead to better results. What are those? What can we learn from them? But bless you as a space that is bringing people together from all over the world at a time when fewer groups are doing that and in a time when it's more needed than ever.
I'll borrow words of wisdom from Gandhi, that he said that it's the action, not the fruit of the action, that's important. You have to do the right thing. It might not be in your power, may not be in your time, that there will be any fruit, but that doesn't mean you stop doing the right thing. You may never know what results come from your action, but if you do nothing, there will be no result.
There was this line from Gramsci where he says, a new world is seeking to be born out of the old. And this is a time of monsters. That's where we are right now. So it's a dangerous time, but it's also a promising time.
You gotta keep going because the world is at stake. Yeah, keep going, keep doing, never give up.
Keep going. Do your best.
You've been listening to History in Action, 50 Years of Activism and Ideas, a 5-part mini-series by the Transnational Institute on its 50th anniversary. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. You can discover more about the Transnational Institute at tni.org. Please consider supporting our vital ongoing work at tni.org/donate. Interviews for this podcast were conducted by Sean Macheza, Daria Goshenina, and Dennis Burke, with archival interviews by Eric Hymans, Fiona Dove, Geoff Arborn, and Breed Brennan. The series is edited and produced by the Transnational Institute. Thanks to Eden Raskin, Susan Buck-Morse, Anthony Burnett, Fiona Dove, Eric Hymans, and the International Institute for Social History.